Coming up on Tech News Today, why Apple really bought PrimeSense apps. Should your DNA be regulated? And what the Bitcoin? Really? $1,000? All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, November 27th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymously and without oversight. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zector.
And I'm WTF Alex, who screwed up a lower third here. Back to you, Tom.
Alex Gumpel filling in for the already Thanksgiving vacationing Jason Howell. And Sarah Lane back for a day. Good to have you back, Sarah. We missed you.
It's good to be back, guys. I missed you.
Just a programming note for those who are not in the United States. We won't have Tech News Today shows Thursday or Friday of this week because of the Thanksgiving holiday weekend here. But we're going to pack three times as much energy and fun in today's show, starting with the top 10 stories of the day in the news feed. Would you like something to be thankful for? Yeah. How about a Snowden leak? No? Okay, well, too bad. You're going to get one anyway. Huffington Post caught this on about the NSA monitoring the habits of six radicals in order to catch them doing things that would undermine their authority in their cause. Vulnerabilities monitored included using donations for personal expenses, charging exorbitant speaking fees, and viewing sexually explicit material online. Dun, dun.
The Washington Post reports that Microsoft executives are meeting this week about talking about encrypting internet traffic to evade possible U.S. National Security Agency's access into its communication links. Sources tell the Post that encryption will take place across the full range of consumer and business services. Microsoft lawyers have called potential NSA activity very disturbing, and they say it could possibly be a breach of the Constitution.
Yeah, so that news of the NSA spying on pretty much everything ever has ruffled a few feathers. The EU may stop its data sharing arrangements due to the surveillance. Now, EU's Justice and Rights Commissioner Viviane Reding says that the U.S. would have to adjust its surveillance practices to be in line with EU law. Additionally, the U.S. would have to allow Europeans whose rights may have been infringed legal redress.
If you don't have Google Glass or Moto X or even an Android phone with a Google app, you can still say OK Glass and get Google to respond. The Google Voice Search Hot Word extension is now available in the Chrome Web Store in beta. The extension allows users to say commands to the browser, just like Google Glass. Google suggests it may be helpful for people who need to do a search this week but have their hands covered in turkey grease, for instance.
Nokia has introduced the Lumia 525 to succeed the popular Lumia 520, which is the top-selling Windows Phone device worldwide. The 525 runs the latest Nokia Lumia Black of Windows Phone 8. It's powered by a 1 gigahertz dual-core Qualcomm Snapdragon processor, 1 gigabytes of RAM, has the same 5-megapixel camera as the 520, 8 gigs of memory, and it also comes in glossy orange, white, yellow, and matte black.
Cloud storage service Box just bought data analytics startup dLoop. The acquisition will bring some more security to Box and help it expand into the enterprise market. Terms of the deal weren't disclosed, but dLoop co-founder Divya Jain will head up Box's advanced content analysis and data classification team.
Everybody wants Captain Kirk to buy their enterprise market. Anyway, MIT Media Lab researchers from the Camera Culture Group have developed a camera that can detect objects even when translucent or obscured by something like rain, all using off-the-shelf parts that total $500 in cost. The key was a change in code that solves the multipath problem, a similar problem that is solved when blurry photos are made sharp with image stabilization. The technology could eventually be used for collision avoidance sensors for cars or even for medical imaging.
Skype use in China used to route through a local company, TOM Online, which made presence of government monitoring pretty certain. Well, Microsoft has now teamed with Guangming founder on a new China-specific Skype build for the app, which GreatFire.org points out encrypts all data and sends it directly to Microsoft. So that would make it harder to censor or spy on any communications, right? Well, Guangming founder was created by Guangming Daily, which is a government-backed newspaper. So don't go telling all your secrets just yet.
Darn. Hold off. If you have bought any video through your Xbox or Windows 8.1 app, you may feel a little locked in, but the lock-in just got a tiny bit less today as Microsoft launched video.xbox.com. You'll be able to watch TV shows and movies you purchase, rent through the Xbox store, or have already purchased, and it's all going to happen in your browser on the web. Now, the stream on the web one is not HD at this point, and you will need the Silverlight plugin.
Yola's first phone has launched, and it runs the Sailfish operating system. Now, Sailfish is the successor to Nokia's MeeGo OS, which debuted and died on the Nokia N900. It's got a new life as Sailfish, though. The Yola phone will be able to run most apps designed for Android. Only 450 Yola phones will be available on its launch today. Most of those will go to customers who pre-ordered.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by ProXPN. You're going to have a lot of time on your hands this week if you're in the U.S. with the Thanksgiving holiday, most likely, unless you're busy like everyone else cooking or standing in line for Black Friday. We're not going to judge what you do. In fact, we don't even want to know what you do, and you shouldn't let anyone else know what you do either. It's none of their business, so use a VPN provider like ProXPN. That's what I do, especially if you're visiting somewhere. Even if it's a relative, but you know, if you're out at a coffee shop or if you're staying in a hotel, don't use their Wi-Fi while you're traveling, at least not without a VPN to protect your bits. 512-bit encryption from ProXPN works by OpenVPN or PPTP. You get to choose which one you like, and it protects yourself against your ISP or that other person sniffing packets in the coffee shop or whoever you want to keep your traffic away from by bypassing filters and restrictions and basically just keeping your data out of their view. ProXPN works for Windows and Mac, offers advanced controls, lets you select the programs and ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. So if you don't care about certain things being routed through the VPN, you don't have to. They can go over your main connection. ProXPN also works with your iOS or Android device. They've even got a brand new Android app in the Google Play Store. Just go check it out. ProXPN.com/twit. For more information and to sign up, ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 a year, but we have got a special offer. Use the code TNT to receive 20% off for the lifetime of your account. It's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. And if you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to ProXPN.com/twit. Sign up with that code TNT. We thank ProXPN for their support of Tech News Today. Give yourself something to be thankful for. Joining us now on our last show of the month, as it turns out, Julio Ojeda Zapata, tech writer for the St. Paul Pioneer Press and author of a brand new book on mobile writing. How's it going, Julio?
Excellent. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Good to have you with us. Let's kick off the discussion stories talking about PrimeSense a little. We talked about this before when Apple affirmed that they are in fact buying PrimeSense, and we were focused on the motion sensing technology. That's what they're most famous for. They made the sensor in the original Kinect. But Jessica Lesson, over at her website, jessicalesson.com, she's a former Wall Street Journal reporter, points out that the PrimeSense acquisition might be about maps. There's a company called Matterport, which makes a camera for mapping three-dimensional spaces, allowing you to walk around in sort of a virtual reality representation of it. And it uses PrimeSense chips in that device, in that scanner. They're beautiful color 3D models of interior spaces. Now, add to that, Jessica Lesson points out, Apple bought Wi-Fi Slam in March. That's an indoor GPS company, which what does it do? Helps you map indoor spaces, things like malls and stuff like that. So PrimeSense could be for motion sensing, could be for making Apple Maps better or putting scanners in your phone or maybe, I don't know, turning all the iPhone users out there into mobile scanners, just mapping the entire world in 3D. Julio, now that you've got this little piece of information in your mind, what do you think Apple's most likely to do with PrimeSense?
Well, I'm still wrapping my head around this, but there's interesting precedent for this. Google, for instance, has recently been very extremely aggressive about documenting indoor spaces as well as outdoor spaces. It has partnered with photographers in different cities to to do 3D photography of malls and stores and so forth. Microsoft has done some interesting virtual reality stuff, outdoor virtual reality stuff, but you know, virtual reality nonetheless. So this is plausible. It's definitely something that I think would work very well.
Yeah, we've seen Apple's maps. They really rely on that whiz bang factor of the 3D maps. You go in and you can see San Francisco look beautiful. You can fly into it. If you had indoor mapping similarly, where you can kind of wander around, that seems like that'd be a nice added feature to Apple Maps, because it has taken a lot of lumps when it comes to its accuracy. If you can make it up in prettiness or have people actually scan stuff for you, that'd be pretty cool. But I would think that Apple would probably use this to have a new feature for something like an iPhone or maybe even their laptops, where you can hold an object up to the camera to show it. Maybe you can find other things that can help you with that, like kind of like genius suggestions for stuff. Maybe that's where they'd go with something like this.
Well, Tom, when you say putting scanners in your phone to turn, you know, any iPhone into like a mapping tool, do you mean something that I, as just a regular consumer, would opt into and say, ooh, look, I'm at the Grand Canyon here, let me add some mapping data that would all sort of be queued together to create something that's three-dimensional and has a bunch of different data points?
Well, not if I want to drive hits to my blog. No, then I suggest that they will secretly do it without your permission. But yeah, I mean, I think something like that is a possibility, right? And I think it's probably even an edge possibility. I think what I guess Apple is doing with this is buying a sensor company that can do a lot of cool things with 3D motion sensing, and they're going to figure out once they get it in what they're going to do with it. But this mapping side of it does fit in very nicely to Apple's efforts to improve maps. They might just want to make a bunch of these things for themselves and not let anybody else have the technology so that their maps could be better. It could be as simple as that. They've got the cash to do that, you know?
And it just dawned on me that they could probably integrate this with iBeacon. iBeacon, another, you know, location-specific technology, could be in some way, you know, be married with this other technology in ways we can't possibly imagine right now.
Yeah. No, there's all kinds of things that they're acquiring out there, and it will be easily to see what kind of stew they serve out of those various pieces of beef and carrots of positioning. All right, that metaphor's done. Let's move on to 23andMe and their FDA regulation problems. What's going on with that, Ios?
Yeah, so on Monday, genetic testing company 23andMe had its service halted due to the FDA. Now, 23andMe, what they do is they analyze a user's saliva and sequences their genome to find out what diseases they may be at risk for or diseases might already have. The FDA says the DNA kit is a medical device, and that requires regulatory approval that 23andMe just doesn't have. The FDA is concerned that people might take actions with the information they are given. So they might have surgeries or they might behave in ways that might be unhealthy that would create a health risk. Now, TechCrunch's Gregory Ferenstein suggests if 23andMe can cause health risks, shouldn't fitness gadgets like the Up and the Fuel Band be regulated the same way? Ferenstein argues that when he tested out the Basis watch, the Fuel Band, and other gadgets, there was a lot of variation in calorie burn measurements compared to the tests he took at Breakaway Performance in San Francisco. They use tests that put a mask over your face, measure energy output from carbon dioxide expulsion. Julio, do you think 23andMe should have been shut down based on what the FDA is saying? And if so, should all fitness gadgets be regulated?
You're probably going to brand me a liberal when I say that. I think where people's health is concerned, more regulation is better than less regulation. I think, you know, when you're talking about people's health, I think you should really take a close look at any technology that sort of impacts people's health. And regulate. The notion of regulating fitness gadgets is not outlandish to me.
You know, the 23andMe letter from the FDA, if you read it closely, shows some frustration on the side of the FDA, which you may or may not be sympathetic with. But it's not like the FDA is contacting them for the first time out of nowhere. 23andMe has been around for 6 years. The FDA has been trying to get them to submit a marketing plan, which those fitness gadgets also probably, in many cases, have to do. You have to be able to back up your claims, right? If you're a vendor of vitamins that says this is going to cure your cancer, you have to be able to back that up. You can't do that. And that's all the FDA wants is, what are your claims? What is your backing for them? And do they meet our guidelines? And apparently 23andMe, for whatever reason, whether they're just too small and busy or whether they're trying to avoid it, have not submitted the claims. So the FDA finally said, look, you got to do this. in 15 days, and we're gonna tell you can't sell your stuff until then, just to get their attention. I really think that's what's going on here. The broader controversy, I think it's a little bit of a slippery slope to say, well, if you regulate 23andMe, then you have to regulate everything that ever existed. I mean, you can go down that slide with health gadgets and all that. There is a real controversy with 23andMe, and there's a good boing boing explanation video of that. Maggie Kurth-Baker has some good links in her article to some reasonable explanation of why 23andMe shouldn't be shut down, because it's our DNA and we should be able to see what's in it. But we also need to have some context, and there probably should be some regulation about the claims you can make based on it, because honestly, they can't tell you much based on your DNA. They can give you like, well, we think that when you have this DNA marker, that you're probably at a percentage risk of we don't have all the data for that. So they really can't make any kind of real claims at all. And I think that's what the FDA is rightly concerned with, which is you're not telling people if you have this gene, you have a 10% chance of getting cancer. Hopefully you're telling them if you have this gene, in many studies, 10% of the time, it's been linked to cancer. But that may be wrong, because as much as we like to think that the science is better than it is in this case, it's just not.
I'm just thinking that a lot of cases in medical schools where students read books and they think they have like every disease they're studying because they just have these psychosomatic feelings. Same thing like with WebMD, people start freaking out because they go, oh, I'll type this in, and turns out they have some kind of plague that it was wiped out, you know, 30, 50 years ago. The idea that because it's device-based causes a concern. But yeah, Tom, you're right. The warning letter does mention how often the FDA has been trying to get 23andMe on their side to get this thing regulated properly. I just don't know if the idea is, do you trust people with health information to the point where they will be making smart decisions? Or is that the cynical part of me saying, is the healthcare industry making stuff seem a lot more dangerous than it is?
I don't think comparing it to a fitness gadget makes any sense at all. Fitness gadget is telling you things like how many steps you walked in, calories, not, you know, if you might be predisposed to some cancer risk later on in life. I think 23andMe in general is pretty benign. I'm not exactly sure why. And the thing is, Tom, you mentioned it sounds like a semantics thing. If you say, hey, Sarah, you might get breast cancer, you have a 10% chance based on your Northern European heritage, that might sound like, okay, well, now I have cause for concern. Maybe it's if it's worded a little bit differently, like studies have shown, and here are the studies, and let's reference them, that you might have this issue, and here's why. It doesn't really mean anything. It's 23andMe doesn't give you some sort of a death sentence. It doesn't tell you when you're going to get sick. It's more based on your genetic history, which I think is really fascinating. And, you know, why wouldn't we be able to have tools like this available to us? I mean, how does the regulation make it better? I have to go to my primary care physician and then they administer my saliva test?
Honestly, I think what regulation would make it better is FDA saying you have to make sure you're explaining to people that we really don't know what this genetic information means. We think it might mean this. That's all. That's the difference, because that's where the science is right now. We tend to think, oh, it's genetic and therefore it's determined. And you just want to make sure people know, like, hey, this is interesting data and you have every right to have it. But you also need some context around how definitive it is. So even if we think this gene is linked to 10% of breast cancer cases, we might do some more studies in the next couple of years that prove that to be absolutely wrong. The science is in very early days. That's what all the geneticists I've read say.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of another technology that has health implications, like electronic cigarettes. It's right now, it's a wild west out there without a lot of government oversight. But these devices where, you know, people are inhaling substances into their bodies. And that's the sort of thing that needs to change. That's the sort of thing that where government has to sort of keep up with technology trends and sort of step in and sort of keep an eye on things.
Well, someday we'll be able to pay for our genetic tests with bitcoins. We might even not need that many of them. They're getting pretty valuable, Sarah.
Yeah, so Bitcoin, everybody drink, passed the $1,000 mark for the first time this week. that says it's the highest that Bitcoin has ever been. There are a variety of exchanges where people buy and sell Bitcoin. Of course, a virtual currency that's internet based. The highest was about $1,030 on Mt. Gox, which is one of the more popular exchanges. It's kind of interesting, though, depending on where you're trading Bitcoin, the numbers do fluctuate. Mt. Gox sometimes is more inflated than others because of high volume of trading, and then difficulty at times to convert back to US dollars. So if you were to look at a bunch of different exchanges, some are over 1,000, some are under, but in general, it's still the highest it's ever been. Last week, though, Bitcoin's high, I think it was last Thursday, was $632. So, I mean, the markup is so ridiculous. And that was, you know, a week ago. Earlier this year, it was not even $100. I mean, it was in the double digits. So wildly fluctuating. We've got, you know, reports. It's, you know, Virgin Galactic is going to be accepting Bitcoin for commercial space travel. You know, everybody in Silicon Valley wants to get on Bitcoin. My tweet stream is full of people saying, "Ah, why did I sell at 200?" And it's kind of this frenzy. Julio, what do you make of all of this? Is Bitcoin just rapidly fluctuating because nobody gets it yet, or is this just is it on the up and up?
Well, I ordered a pizza with Bitcoin the other day. No, I'm kidding. I honestly don't know. I'm bracing myself for a Bitcoin crash at some point, and really still wrapping my head around this thing. I don't really, really, truly know where this is going to go. I just find it. I find the whole thing fascinating.
I have 6 Bitcoins. Should I sell them?
You're basically, what you're saying is you're super rich.
I'm going to buy a yacht today. But
what happens, Tom? I mean, you know, this is just like any kind of, you know, investment that it, even though it's Bitcoin, the rules still apply. What do you do? How long do you hold on for? What kind of confidence do you have in this, you know, wild west of Bitcoin markets?
My real honest personal thought is just hold on to them. It's hard to get them in and out of Mt. Gox, which is why they hit $1,000 on Mt. Gox and not the other exchanges. And I just don't see it as something that makes sense for me to cash in on. And I may prove to be stupid on that. But I feel like, well, if I'd cashed in at $500 when everybody said, then I'd feel stupid now. So I'm just going to hold on to them and see what they end up being worth in the future, you know, down the line. I see them as not a long-term investment because I didn't put that much thought into them, but just something to see what happens, see what I can do with them, because just turning them into dollars kind of loses the fun, which is not why you should invest, and I don't see them as an investment strategy.
I don't know. Maybe I'm kind of... burned out on investments in general. So it's like, okay, well, this is a nice new thing to invest in. This is just another vehicle. You could probably get bonds, stocks, or if you want to get Bitcoin or you want to invest in another currency out there, you could do that. The idea that it's hitting over $1,000, like, that seems pretty impressive, because this seems like something that could have literally just been something that people wouldn't accept, to say this is something silly. It's not a real currency. The fact that it's managing to hit this much value shows that there's a tremendous market out there that does value this, and it's going to continue as long as people believe in it, it works. Same thing like the US dollar, right? It's backed by nothing but a government. So as long as people believe in it, it works.
I mean, I have a bunch of baseball cards sitting in a closet too for the same reason. So I'll probably just end up holding on to these forever. I was having this conversation this morning with Eileen, though. Do we think that Bitcoin will end up becoming a legit currency in the future? Because I don't. I think it's going to either pave the way for another follow-on currency that fixes some of its problems, or it's going to be a niche thing that you use for certain transactions, and it will find its place on the web.
I mean, it is a legit currency.
I guess it is now. You're right.
You can get those US dollars if you want them, but yeah, it's there's also, you know, there's just shadiness. A lot of and really, I mean, people like me, it's like, I'm fascinated by Bitcoin. I think about it all the time. And the more I read about it, the more I'm like, okay, I need to like go back to take a little Bitcoin refresher course, because it's confusing. It's confusing for a lot of people. It's exciting. and clearly very volatile. And yeah, I mean, in 6 months, will those six Bitcoins of yours be worth $12,000 or a lot less? It's like impossible for anybody to know.
Yeah, exactly. What we do know is that Microsoft just won't leave Google alone. What are they doing this time, Mayas?
There's a new commercial out. The latest ad features the guys from Pawn Stars. If you haven't watched Pawn Stars, it's a reality show that follows the lives of pawn shop owners. And the video...
I hear it over the back fence because my neighbor watches it.
Okay, so that's how Tom knows it. You might know it from watching it on TV. But in this video, a woman tries to pawn her Google Chromebook to get a ticket to Hollywood from Las Vegas. The pawn shop owners laugh and tell the woman that the Chromebook isn't a real laptop. We got a clip of the video.
That means it's not a real laptop. It doesn't have Windows or Office. Without Wi-Fi, it doesn't do much at all. And when you are online, Google tracks what you do so they can sell ads. That's how you get scroogled.
Yeah, so he also says in the video that traditional PCs utilizes built-in applications like Office and iTunes that work even when you're offline. And the pawn shop owner doesn't even buy the laptop. The woman is left dejected as she can't go to Hollywood. And by the way, I did a quick search this morning on Hipmunk. What does it cost to go from Las Vegas to Hollywood? It's about $260. So there's, you can't even get that much apparently from the Chromebook if you wanted to go today based on that one. Julio, is the Chromebook even enough of a threat that Microsoft had to make a commercial against it?
Well, full disclosure, I'm a huge Chromebook fan. I just love the devices to death. And I think the situation is a little more nuanced than Microsoft puts it. Chromebooks do have their flaws. You know, if you're offline, your capabilities are somewhat limited, though not completely negated. But you know, the downfalls on the Microsoft side are equally valid. Windows, you know, there's a lot of Windows overhead. It's just overkill for a small, inexpensive mobile device that you want to take on the road and just do, you know, simpler things. And so it's a little bit of a low blow. I mean, Microsoft is sliming Chromebooks in a way that I think is unfair. They're making some valid points, but then they're extrapolating them to say that Chromebooks are completely worthless and useless and you should go Windows. And that's not the case.
You know, when you're in second place, you attack the leader. When you're in first place, you tout your benefits. This implies that Microsoft feels they're in second place in this space of sub-$500 computing devices, whether you're talking about the Microsoft Surface or Windows-based machines. Paul Theriot had a tweet this morning. He wrote up an article about, if you're thinking about getting a Chromebook, here are five Windows-based products you should consider instead. So they are definitely in a head-to-head battle for this marketplace, and apparently Microsoft feels threatened by the fact that people look at the Chromebook and think, I'm getting a laptop for $229, and so they want to point out all the flaws in it and say, hey, we've got better stuff. Maybe you'll pay less for a tablet version with Windows on it, or maybe you'll pay a little more, but you'll get so much more if you buy a Windows-based version. I think that's what's going on here.
Yeah, and Microsoft wants to make sure that you know that this is another vehicle for Google to spy on you because you sign in and they're watching everything you're doing. It's weird they always keep saying, you know, they're stealing your data when you're actually signing up to do it. I know that Microsoft has that new apparel you can get, you know, keep calm and what is it, and steal my data and have it's a British parody thing. Anyway, I don't think this is necessary at all. I don't think Microsoft have anything to worry about with the Chromebooks because you can run Office in the browser on Chromebook if you wanted to.
The commercial is fascinating, though. I mean, there are so many like seedy elements that Microsoft wants you to think about Google, right? It's like a woman going from Las Vegas to Hollywood. Those could both be seen as two places where dreams go to die, right? She's at a pawn shop. The pawn shop owner is like, not even good enough for me, the pawn shop owner. It's like, Microsoft, my goodness. It's kind of funny, but it also kind of comes across as like, really, Microsoft, are you still doing this? Scroogled? That was very last year.
Somebody in the chat room mentions it's about $60 to get a bus ticket. So you can't even get $60 for a Chromebook. And there's the mug that says, keep calm while we steal your data. This is on sale now at the Microsoft store. Out of stock right now. With the Chrome logo on it from Microsoft.
I think, honestly, whatever you think about which one's better, whether you're a fan of one or the other or both, that this is a really interesting battle going on. Who would have thought before netbooks came along that we would have this kind of price point capacity battle within a few years. It kind of looked a couple years ago like netbooks were totally dead anyway, and that was going away. And of course they are, but people still like the idea of paying a couple $100 for a laptop like device. And there's a lot of people scrambling to get that money. And what's interesting is Apple's not in this particular space. They're in the tablet space, obviously, but they're not in this sub $500, you know, minimal use laptop space that the Chromebook and the Surface arguably and lots of other low end laptops are in. Well, a lot of folks here in the United States are going to be traveling for Thanksgiving holidays this week, and Google wants to help them out, Sarah. That's so nice of them.
It's so nice of them, except that really this is all done internationally, even though Thanksgiving, at least not Canadian Thanksgiving, but U.S. Thanksgiving is tomorrow. Many other places in the world don't celebrate it, but Google is adding a variety of insides of airports and train stations to Street View. A lot of places in Europe, in Asia, even in Africa. So Google Street View program manager Ulf Spitzer says, in addition to scoping out your destination, Street View can help you cut down the stress of traveling by giving you a preview of your journey too. The new additions include 16 airports and 50 train and subway stations. Again, like I said, none of these new additions are in the U.S. at all. But hey, a lot of people might be traveling from an international airport to one in the U.S. So there's still just a high volume of travel happening. You know, it's funny. I liked the story this morning because I was leaving JFK Airport, one of the largest in the world, yesterday. And I was really worried that it was going to be a nightmare because it was 2 days before Thanksgiving. And the place was a ghost town, at least in the terminal that I was in. And yeah, I was kind of like, well, I guess maybe somewhere a lot of people are traveling. It's certainly not in this airport. I didn't think it was difficult to get through security or figure out where my gate was or anything like that. Although if you're in a new airport for the first time, it can be certainly confusing. Heathrow is one of those airports. Also, I love the idea of the subways, being able to navigate through there if you happen to be one of these people who really likes to plan ahead. And basically, when you get into the subway, especially if there's signs posted in a language you don't understand, you kind of know where you need to go, which, you know, train platform you need to go to. So yeah, I don't know how Thanksgiving focused this really is. It's kind of just timely. But Julio, do you find yourself wanting to virtually walk through places like airports and stations?
Well, one moment. We're calling him right back.
Oh, okay. Tom, what about you?
I could see this becoming handy in a couple of airport situations where I'm looking for a particular like food location, right? I walk out and I see the fast food joint that I don't ever want to have to eat at. And I'm like, what are my other options? That could be time consuming and difficult. So if this were able to help me with that, it'd be great. And also like, where's the cabs? Where's the ground transportation? Where's the parking lot? That kind of stuff. I'd be able to look at that ahead of time. That can, you know, shave some seconds off your journey in an unfamiliar airport for sure. And totally agree with you on the subway system. I've used Google Maps for subway directions in New York before, and it's pretty handy. This would just make it even better, I think.
Yeah, I'm pretty spatially dense when it comes to these kinds of things. So when it comes to...
You're very compact.
When it comes to airports, the more information I have about an unfamiliar airport, the better. That way I can have kind of like a relative knowledge of where stuff is next to each other, because there's enough stress in air travel, and then there's usually tons of people traveling at the certain times I travel, and so you want to be able to get to these locations easier. I mean, it's a smart little play at the right time because people have travel in their mind right now. The subway system, I don't know how updated that information is at times. That seems like it'd be a good idea, but the question is, will it give you timely data when you need it? Because subway stuff changes a lot, at least in New York it used to. I don't know how it is everywhere else.
I just think, you know, it's nice that in the not too far distant future, this stuff will all just be, you can just virtually walk through any station, any airport. We'll laugh about the times where, you know, you got to an airport and then wondered where you're supposed to go. It's just the beginning of well, not public places, but places where there's a lot of foot traffic. You know, a mall has that whole idea of Google Street View being inside a mall. I'm like, ugh. I mean, I don't get anything out of that. But something like a subway station in Tokyo, that's really confusing, I'm in.
I'm inclined to disagree with that statement, particularly in light of a huge mall we have here in Minnesota called the Mall of America. That thing is ginormous. Any guidance that can be provided for people that don't know it as well as I do is a very good idea.
That's true. I hadn't been thinking about that. I think Toronto has a big one like that as well. There's more of them all around the world, actually. Huge stuff. So that might be useful. Look, you can even use it inside the Twit Studios.
Yeah, it's not our little mall of America.
Yeah, if you get lost in here, you'll know how to handle this.
You know, the first time you're in there, it actually can be kind of confusing.
And Andy Inoko is always sitting at that table.
He'll always be sitting there.
Forever. And I'm talking to him.
All right, let's finish off our discussion section with that $500 sensor camera we were talking about in the news fuse. These are MIT researchers led by Ramesh Raskar who developed a 3D nano camera based on something called time flight technology, and that's what the Kinect uses as well. When an object's location is calculated by measuring the time it takes light to reflect off its surface and return to the sensor, that's time flight technology. Now, the problem is, when it reflects off of translucent things or things that are partially translucent, it can get blurry. The pixels just don't register the way they should. So nanocams can capture those translucent and moving objects in 3D. Now, a common method used in telecom to solve multipath problems is part of the solution here. They used similar techniques that clear up blurry photos if you have image stabilization, but they applied it to this time flight technology. They've done it before, but they had to use some pretty expensive $500,000 femto cameras to do it. Since they were able to do most of the processing in the algorithm this time, the off-the-shelf part they used cost $500. So this is a much more cost-effective way to do this. They probed the scene with a continuous wave signal that oscillates at nanosecond periods, hence it's called a nano camera. And that way, they can use those off-the-shelf parts to capture the light reflecting back and then process the data. This is the kind of thing, as I mentioned in the news feeds, could be used in medical imaging, could be used as collision avoidance detectors, so it would make self-driving cars better. In the Engadget post, they speculate that maybe it would be able to tell a cat in the rain from a puddle in the rain, which could be difficult with the rain confusing the sensors. Sarah, I know that warms your heart, that more cats would be safe from self-driving cars in the future, right?
Yeah. I mean, because one of the most annoying things about driving today is confusing cats and puddles.
Oh, come on. You know you don't want to think of kitties getting hit by self-driving cars.
I certainly don't. No. I think that's great. Hey, if self-driving cars are in our immediate future, then the sensors have to be as smart as possible. So, sure. Yes. I wouldn't want, crazy extreme braking because the car thinks it's a cat when it's really just a puddle. So, yeah, I mean, it's you're going to have to distinguish between actual obstacles and non-threatening ones.
Julio, what do you make of this? Besides the medical imaging, car sensing, anything else occur to you, or is that good enough? Those are pretty good uses.
Well, my mind was kind of blown by this, and I'm reminded of the comic books I used to read as a kid. They had the little ads in the back for the X-ray specs, and I think we're moving ever closer to that ideal. I'm kind of excited. I guess my point is the human eye is inadequate for many tasks. And technology more and more. I'm reminded of the Lytro camera, for instance, and this technology. And technology more and more is becoming able to view and to sense and to analyze our surroundings in ways the human eye can't. And again, my mind is blown. I'm just wondering where we're going to go with this. It's very exciting.
Medical research definitely seems like the best usage for something like this. If you can have this low-cost device, you can probably have it in a lot more like emerging markets and things, because when you have medical advances, they're usually very expensive and they're limited to like the best hospitals, the best places on Earth. But at $500, that's a really that democratizes this potential. So we'll see how this goes. But I'm really interested in how this is going to get to the consumer market. At some point, we're going to have silly cameras that can do this kind of stuff. But the first thing, medical makes the most sense to me.
Now you'd think that might be the randomizer, but it wasn't. Let's fire up the randomizer, shall we, Alex? Unleash it. Randomize it. We did a straw poll today, 181 total votes, and the winner by a nose, 2 votes. One restaurant offering a 50% discount if you turn your phone off while you dine. This is in an Arab-Israeli restaurant outside of Jerusalem. It's called Abu Ghosh. He got so tired of, he says, actually having to take diners' meals back and reheat them because they were so distracted with their phone that they let their food get cold. That he did this shtick of saying, I'll give you 50% off your bill if you don't use your phone through the entire meal. Apparently, a lot of people taking him up on it. He's losing some money. I don't know. I thought it was pretty entertaining, but maybe it's just me.
Well, no, it's not just you. Obviously, the chat room totally agrees with you. The straw poll says it's a winner. I'm not a big fan of when I'm at a table and everybody's got their phone out. And sometimes I forget my phone that I'm the only guy who's actually paying attention to what's going on. And I notice it might be somebody like Alex who's carrying three phones at one time. And he's actually comparing photos of whatever he just took a photo of on every single device. So if we could change this behavior with discounts, maybe. But
No. Just this is stupid. You know what this is? It's like. Hey, you know, you get to go into the carpool lane if you have three people in your car and then somebody puts like a dummy in the back seat. It's like you're going to have all these people who pretend to turn off their phones, but then they don't really turn off their phones. And then they demand a cheaper meal. And I don't like the idea of a restaurant telling me what to do with my little pocket computer. It's very helpful for a variety of reasons. Wherever I am, when I'm dining or otherwise, I completely understand a no talking on the phone policy. You see those little signs in cafes all over the place now, and I always honor them. I don't really like talking on the phone anyway, but like, oh, people who are better than me get to have a cheaper meal.
This is incentivizing. This is not ordering you to do anything.
Hey, why stop there?
If
you're not paying attention to your food, you have to pay 50% more. Let's just do that.
That's the way to spin it. Tom, you're really good at link bait this morning. That's restaurant charges double for those who use phones. That's the headline.
It's hard to set global policies like this because even one person's behavior can vary dramatically from circumstance to circumstance. Like, for instance, I run in a very geeky crowd when I'm with my friends at a restaurant, say, it's perfectly acceptable for all of us to have our phones out and to be fiddling with them. And it's perfectly fine. Nobody's offended. We're still good friends. We don't feel like we're ignoring each other. But if I'm with my wife and my kid, it's a completely different situation. No phones on the table, no fiddling with gadgets, you know, focus on the meal, focus on who's eating the meal and so forth.
Ayaz, pay attention.
Oh, sorry.
Hey, it bothers me
that the implication is you're a better person if you're not using your phone at this restaurant. So if you want to be a better person, you don't have to pay as much for your food. There are a lot of really interesting things that you can do on your phone if you have the appropriate people at your table who don't mind. Also, what if I'm dining alone?
You know, if his real frustration is people sending their food back to be reheated because they're so distracted, just charge them to have it reheated if it's their own fault. You know, if they immediately get the food and it's cold, don't charge them then. That's your fault. But if they wait 30, 45 minutes and go, oh, I forgot to start eating my food. Can you reheat this? Like, sure, yeah, but that's going to be a 20% surcharge on your... Don't punish people for doing what they do in the world we live in. That's like saying you people are not dressed for dinner in your tuxedos because that used to be the norm, right? It's the new norm. The new norm is being developed. That's what I think. Speaking of the future, let's look at the calendar.
Oh, I'm all heated up now, but this is good news.
Alex, stop playing with your phone and run the calendar.
Better not reheat that phone. I can tell you, it does not work. On Friday, the 29th, the XI3's Piston Modular PC is launching for $1,000 or one Bitcoin.
That's right. Instagram equals one Bitcoin.
Although on Friday, your Bitcoin might not be enough to buy the modular PC.
That's still a lot of Instagrams, but fewer than it used to be. All right. I bet we have an email or something, don't we?
Incoming message.
I bet you're right. And this one's from Kirk with the subject line, benchmarking refrigerators.
Yes.
I am that appliance benchmarking guy. Thanks to the help from the EPA, I've always looked at energy usage like CPU benchmarking. In both cases, I ask, how much bang can I get for my buck? Funny twist, LG got in trouble for tweaking their results just like Samsung and HTC, which stands for has to cheat. He sent us a link to twice.com. Love the show. Keep up the great work and the puns, too.
Does that count as benchmarking? I guess it does. It's a kind of benchmarking. I think
you're
we were thinking
at a workbench.
Like speed tests on the processor in your smart fridge. But yeah, actually, I do that, too. I definitely look at that stuff. So Kirk may not be as alone as he thinks he is. in benchmarking refrigerators now that he puts it that way. Good stuff. Well, thank you, Julio Ojeda Zapata, for joining us today. Always a pleasure to have you along. As we mentioned, you got a new book out. Tell us about it. Tell us what's going on with it.
Well, mobile devices are increasingly being used for productivity. Almost everybody has an iPad or a Chromebook or an Android tablet. And almost everyone at one point or another wants to write on the devices. But not everybody is really sure how to go about it. They're not sure what's the right device for this sort of thing. What kind of Bluetooth keyboard should I get? What kind of writing apps are out there? I mean, how do you put the pieces together to be productive in the writing sense on a mobile device? A lot of people are asking these questions, have always been asking me that very question. And so I just kind of put together a book where I go by platform, iOS, Android, Chromebook, Surface, and just tell people, here's how you put together a scenario with the hardware and the software that'll let you, you know, crank out whatever kind of writing you want to do. The book is not just for professional writers, or it's for anybody that wants to write on their devices and wants to do so comfortably, efficiently, and enjoyably.
And you've got the magic price of $299 on it, which I've read is like the top sales price.
I think that's a limited time price during the holiday season. So
check it out. Get it quick. Go look it up. Look for Julio Ojeda Zapata on Amazon. Or what's the URL where people can find it again?
It's in the lower third, I think, but it's OJEZAP/TheMobileWriter. OJEZAP/TheMobileWriter.
OJEZAP.com/TheMobileWriter. Thank you again, Julio. Don't forget about our technewstoday.reddit.com subreddit as well, where you can submit stories and vote them up or down. We've also got an email address. You can email us stuff, tnt@twit.tv. Let us know if you benchmark refrigerators or what the strangest thing you've ever benchmarked.
If you bench press a refrigerator, let us know.
Bench press, send pics. Call us, pics of your pics. Call us 260-TNT-SHOW if you'd like to leave us a voicemail of you while you're bench pressing a refrigerator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/technewstoday, which I don't know. Maybe someday all four of us will be bench pressing refrigerators on that channel. You just don't know. Subscribe to the podcast, twit.tv/TNT. And you can also get us again on Monday. Don't forget, we'll be off Thursday and Friday, but we'll be back Monday. And Molly Wood promises she'll be with us then. We'll see you on Monday. Happy Thanksgiving, USans.